Well, good morning.
Let's open with a word of prayer. Father, what a joy to be with your people this morning as we have these moments to bow down before you and to open our hearts to your word. And Lord, may we understand what you would have us to learn from your word today. And Lord, we ask that you might help us as we look at this new book. And thank you for the Romans study. And now as we look at a prophet in the Old Testament, Lord, just to fix our minds on you, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Jesus, what a wonder you are. You are so gentle, so pure and so kind. You shine like the morning star. Jesus, what a wonder you are. Well, who can pronounce the name of Ezekiel correctly? That isn't the correct pronunciation, by the way. Well, in Hebrew, there's no long E's, so it's Ezekiel. But you can call it Ezekiel, because who would call it? I'm studying the book of Ezekiel. Oh, yeah, really good. That's good. We have a prophet here who is a contemporary of Jeremiah and Daniel. And so, you know, sometimes when you take these online correspondence courses, the first thing they do is they give you a quiz to see what your proficiency level has increased during your little course. So I'm going to give you a proficiency exam this morning. Anyway, question number one is on the second page. Good morning, Claude. What is the theme of Ezekiel? Glory of God is a good one. There's different commentators have different ones, and some say it's the restoration of the spiritual heart of Israel, which it is. But we're also really going to be looking at the glory of God. I think that's a good one. There's a key phrase used 70 times in the book of Ezekiel. Do you know what it is? Oh, wow. All right. Let's go have coffee.
Well,
you guys
right on the front page, because everybody was...
Well, but now you're the only one who can read, I guess. Nobody else saying. Okay, how many times is the Lord God used in the book of Ezekiel? Did you count them already? Wow, that's great. Okay. Man, these questions are too easy. Well, all the answers are right down below, but some of these will get a little harder maybe. What are the dates of Ezekiel's writings? Dates. When did he begin writing? Okay, very good. How many deportations from Jerusalem to Babylon? You probably know that without looking at any paper. Just look at me. Don't look at your paper. I mean, that's not fair to look at your paper.
Three.
Who said three? Good. What's the date of the first one?
605.
Yes, absolutely. Who was taken, which prophet was taken captive then?
Daniel.
Very good. Man, you're right on it. What's the date of the second one? Yeah, which prophet was taken captive then?
Jeremiah.
Jeremiah was never taken captive by the Babylonians.
Ezekiel.
How do we know he was taken then? Well, the first 24 chapters, we find he will be prophesying of the fall of Jerusalem. And so he began his ministry 6 years before Jerusalem was destroyed. And so we're pretty sure. And he also talks about our captivity several different times. So there's not much question. And he says, when I was at the canal, Shebar, is when he's doing these writings. So we're pretty sure of that. Very good. Okay, what events bookend Ezekiel's writings? Or when do they? What events, what is the event that we already talked about it that begins? What is the event that ends it? Has it happened yet?
No.
So what is that event? The millennial reign. We will have the last nine chapters all about the millennial temple. Interesting, huh? So we've got a prophecy here that goes from about 600 B.C. to we don't know how long, because it's already 2,000 years after Christ. So it's already been 2,600 and may go a little longer yet. But we're expecting the Lord to return soon, aren't we? So we have some aspects of the millennial reign here at the end of the book. Do you think it's strange that all the final kings of Judah did not listen to Jeremiah prophesying in Jerusalem and Ezekiel prophesying in Babylon?
Yeah. No.
How similar is that of the leaders today, of the church today? It's very similar, isn't it? Is the church really concerned? Is the church really committed to prayer? Is the church really committed to purity? All you read about are all kinds of fundraising things. You got the emergent church going into all kinds of strange doctrine. You've got all kinds of division. You've got homosexual preachers. You've got arguments going on as to homosexuality in the church and all these kinds of things which are very clearly taught in the scriptures. But the church is out to lunch, isn't it, generally speaking? Or worse, is dead in Europe, dying in Korea, and so-so in China. And it's, you know, the places where there's persecution is so strong. And we may see quite a rebirth now in the Arab world because there's a lot of things happening there, aren't there? Many of the things being shaken up. But that's still to be seen. Is that going to be good for the Christians or bad for the Christians? We don't know. But chances are there's going to be more and more persecution, I would think. Okay. How do you see the faithfulness and mercy of God in Ezekiel's writings? Or do you? Well, if he's talking about the millennial reign, is that all bad? When he's telling Israel that they're going to be destroyed, that's bad news. But then the Lord never leaves us generally in bad news, because he will, before he's going to talk about in Ezekiel 36 about the new covenant, how he's going to pour out a new spirit on them, how he's going to pour out and give them new hearts. He's going to replace their heart of stone with a heart of flesh, so that we will keep his judgments and we will do his statutes, not because we have to, because we want to, and that he will be our God and we will be his people. And so the loving, compassionate God, he is, and his love and compassion never cease. Okay, turn to page 4. Those of you who were honest and didn't look back, the answers are all in page 4 up at the top there if you want to see them. Now, in the middle are the names of 5 of the last kings of Judah, and I just want to dwell on those a little bit because we want to look at the context of when this book was written. At the very end, we had the last king of Judah was Zedekiah. His name, he was the fourth son of Josiah, we believe, maybe the third. We don't know how many sons Josiah had. We had 4 sons by name of Josiah. Well, let's go back up to 16th king in the of Judah was Josiah. He was 8 years old when he came to the throne. That was about 640 B.C., about 291 years after Solomon's reign. And he reigned 31 years. And the prophets at that time were Jeremiah and Zephaniah. Jeremiah was the major one at that time. And Jeremiah prophesied much of Josiah, or some of Josiah's reign. Quite a bit of it, actually. Then we have the next king that came along was Shalom. He was called Jehoahaz. He came to the throne at age 23, we're told, and he began his reign in 609 B.C., and he had a very long reign of 3 months. Then, that's about the time things are falling apart, but he was wicked. Then he was replaced with Jehoiakim, who is another son of Josiah. He was 25 when he took over, and he reigned 11 years. And we think Habakkuk was probably prophesying during that time. Then we have his son, Jehoiachin, Jeconiah, who was really a wicked guy, but he only reigned 3 months. In the book of Kings, it says he was 18. In the book of Chronicles, it says he was 8 when he ascended the throne. So that's always one question you'll get by people that know the Bible and people that don't know the Bible, but people that say, oh, there's inconsistencies in the Bible. There are some inconsistencies in the Bible, particularly in the area of numbers, and this is one of them. And the numbering system in Hebrew is a number of dots and things, and so sometime a dot is missed or whatever. Because of the relative maturity describing this guy when he became king, it would be unlikely that he was 8 years old. It's probably more likely that he was 18. But you can be the judge of whatever you want. You want him to be 8 or you want him to be 18? He only reigned 3 months, so what difference does it make, right? he wasn't much, but a wicked guy. And then he was replaced, and we'll get into this a little bit as we go through a little more narrative here, but he was replaced then by Zedekiah. Actually, the guy's name was Mattaniah. He was the son of Josiah, and he was named Zedekiah. Now, we have these names are so similar here, Jehoiakim and Jehoiachin, and it gets a little bit confusing, but maybe this table will keep in the back of your mind, and you can look at it as you want. The prophet on the right side at the bottom there is Ezekiel 592 to 571, and that's contemporary with Daniel. Now, interesting that when Ezekiel was born, we think Ezekiel was born somewhere around 622, because he's going to tell us he's 25, he's going to tell us he's 30 years old. He was 25 when he was taken captive. So here you can imagine a young guy, really, right? 25 years old, taken out of his country. He's called the priest. Actually, that was by bloodline, really, because he was the son of Buzi, who was another priest. But he never really got to be a priest too much because, I mean, he's taken out of Israel when he's 25. The priests began their service at when? 30. How long did they go?
50.
Well, that's in Numbers 4. Now, we'll also see, if you look at Ezekiel's prophesying in his ministry, it's exactly that, 30 to 50, or at least 30 to 49 is what we see here. So, and these dates are, proximate. But Ezekiel has more specific dates than any other prophet. I mean, he not only talks about the year, he talks about the month, and he talks about the day in many cases. Amazing, amazing accuracy. Now, the bottom dates on page 4, I think, are something that you might want to remember. We don't know before Abraham, and the 2000 is an approximate date. We don't even know about Abraham. Abraham might go as far back as 2200 B.C., but somewhere around 2000 B.C. I like to think of it this way, real simply. Abraham, 2000 years before Christ. David, 1000 years before Christ. The Exodus kind of in the middle. It's actually 1446 B.C. based on Solomon's dating. But 1446, so that's roughly 1500. So that's about halfway between Abraham and David. And then we come on up with the northern kingdom falling. Do you know when the northern kingdom fell? You got all the other dates.
931.
Huh?
931.
Who said 7?
700.
722. 722. If you look down here at 722, you'll see it. Assyria conquers the northern kingdom. Anyway, Abraham 2000 B.C., the Exodus 1446. In 1050, that's when Saul became king and they began a monarchy. That lasted for 119 years and the kingdom was divided at the death of Solomon in 931 B.C. So we see about 200 years after that, the northern kingdom falls. Now, the northern kingdom consisted of how many tribes?
Ten
tribes. And you remember Jeroboam was the guy who became king when the Lord really ripped the kingdom in two, which he said he would do because of Solomon's sin. You know, Solomon broke all four rules, right? You weren't to multiply silver, you weren't to multiply gold, you weren't to multiply horses, and you weren't to have multiple wives. Solomon did all four of those things. And God said, because of your father David, I will not take the kingdom away from you, but after you, it will be. And of course, you know the story with Rehoboam, the way the Lord worked that out. Rehoboam was asked how he was going to, because the taxes were really heavy on the people. And he talked to the old guys, and the old guys said, go easy on the people, and they will follow you. And the young guy said, don't listen to that. Tell them that as thick as your father's finger was a burden, mine is going to be as thick as your leg. And so they, in effect, said, get out of here. We don't need you. And they rebelled. He sent a guy up to the northern kingdom to collect taxes because they wouldn't pay him, and they killed him. And so then the kingdom was split. So Jeroboam, who was becoming a strong guy during Solomon's reign, when Solomon basically was going to kill him, so he exiled himself to Egypt until Solomon died. Then he came back, and he became the king of the northern kingdom, which was the 10 tribes, called Israel. The southern kingdom was called Judah. It consisted of Judah and Benjamin, those two tribes. And so we have then, Jeroboam did not want the people going to Jerusalem to worship, so he built two golden what?
Calves.
One was at the south end in Bethel, which is not very far from Jerusalem, and the other one was at the north end of Israel, which was at Dan. So from the very beginning, they're worshiping idols, right? They had no Levitical kings, they just appointed kings. You want to, or a priest. You want to be a priest? Good. You can be a priest. You want to be a priest? Fine, you'll be a priest. And so they didn't follow the Lord at all. And so the Lord never blessed the northern kingdom, as you can imagine. And they had all bad kings. There wasn't one good king in the northern tribe. So, consequently, that fell first in 722. And at that time, Assyria was the world power. Now, in 612, which was 110 years later, Nineveh, which is a strong city, you know, the city that Jonah was sent to and so forth, Nineveh falls to the Medes and the Babylonians. So now Assyria is going to fall because in a few, 7 more years, at the Battle of Carchemish, a very famous battle, this is where Nebuchadnezzar II was his first battle as a young general. And he defeated the Assyrians and the Egyptians. They came together against him. And he defeated them, and that was one of the biggest battles in the ancient world. And so at that time, Babylon now becomes a world power at 605. So Babylon now is 605. Immediately, he moves on down after that victory to Jerusalem and sets siege to it and takes the first deportation, which would include Daniel. And we'll get into this a little bit later, but he set up this vassal, which is one of the sons of Josiah, and then all these guys that got set up or became kings in Judah at that time, they all eventually, some soon, some a few more years, they would rebel against Babylon. And so then Babylon would come and whack them again. And so finally then, the second time around, Ezekiel was taken captive, a bunch of others. Third time around, we'll mention that a little later, but anyway, the guy is really in Nebuchadnezzar's face, so Nebuchadnezzar with rage goes over and wipes him out. Destroys Jerusalem, destroys the temple, took everybody that was left that was worth anything. The real poor people and so forth, they didn't have really any talents, they left them there. But that was 586. Judah falls to Babylon, Jerusalem destroyed, the temple destroyed. Then, 50 years later, Babylon falls to Persia. So you see, these world powers don't last very long, do they? And you remember Daniel's vision of the figure, right? Now, his head was Babylon. He didn't go back beyond that in that particular one. But we have then we had the Greeks and the Romans and so forth. So, but Babylon falls to Persia in 536. Then in 331, that's 205 years later, Greece conquers Judah. So now we got Alexander the Great on the scene. And, of course, Alexander the Great conquers everything that there is to conquer, and then he dies. Kind of an alcoholic. He had nothing more to live for, I guess, because he conquered everything, and he died. And so in 63 B.C., Rome conquers Judah. Now Rome is the world power. And so you see this succession of powers. 168, called the Abomination of Desolation. That's not the Abomination of Desolation that we refer to in Scripture of the Antichrist, but this is a type of that. And this Antiochus IV Epiphanes, he goes in to the temple and offers a pig on the altar and so forth. So it was a terrible abomination at that time and caused the Jews to revolt one thing or another. That was 168 B.C. Then 63 B.C., as I mentioned, Rome conquered Judah. And then there's a difference. It used to be accepted that 4 B.C. was the birthday to Christ because we had the death of Herod the Great as 4 B.C., and so Herod was alive when Jesus was born, right? So they said, well, Jesus had to be born before Herod died. But now there appears to be some information that says that Herod may not have died until a little after 0 B.C., whatever it is about the birth of Christ. So I'm not sure Jesus is born 4 years before he was born. But anyway, These are all calendar dates, and they aren't really real exact. And we had some changes in the calendars, too. But anyway, those are dates that you can remember and put in the back of your mind as you need them to keep some of these things in order. Because, you know, when you have all these world powers, you have Assyria, then you have the Babylonians, and then you have the Persians, and then you have the Greeks, and then you have the Romans. I mean, it can get really confusing if you don't kind of have a timeline in mind. Okay, well, look at the outline last. But now on page 2, if you'll turn there for a minute. The theme of the book, I think, can be described, as already was mentioned, the glory of God. We'll certainly see that, I believe, in chapter 1, as we get into that a couple of weeks from today. I'm going to be gone a couple of weeks. And David, you're all set for the next 2 weeks, right? So David's going to have the class the next 2 weeks. But as we get into chapter 1, I think a good idea to keep in mind is, how can this be the glory of God being described here? But I think that's what it is. And so the glory of God is the theme. The Hebrew word for glory has the idea of heaviness. I mean, how would somebody describe the glory of God? How do you describe it? You got a couple of days? It does. The word is kabod. You know, the absence of glory is what? Ichabod. You know, that's what they named the guy, who was it, the fat guy, what was his name, the priest, that fell over and broke his neck. Anyway, his grandson. Eli, yeah. So when Eli's, they sent the, you know, he had the bad sons, right? And that was just a mess. And he sent the ark into the battle, which was the wrong thing to do. And of course, the ark got taken. And then darkness came, and Eli's two boys were killed. But one of them had a wife who was pregnant. And then when he was born, he was called Ichabod. How would you like to be called Ichabod? It means the glory's departed. And not too good news, is it? But there is a lot said in here in the Hebrew of kabod. Kabod, meaning the glory. And it kind of means heavy. Heavy not in terms necessarily of a big burden, of a weight, of a weight of pounds, but it really means substantial, unlimited kind of a thing. The brilliance. I like it, the brilliance of the Lord. But anyway, however you want to define it. Key phrase, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, I use 70 times. The Lord God term is used over 400 times. I counted all. No, I didn't either. Didn't count any of them. I just, that was given to me. And the phrase, I am the Lord, 59 times. The context of Ezekiel, we talked a little bit about it. Would you turn back to 2 Kings 24, and we'll just look at the biblical commentary, which is the best. Biblical commentary is always the most correct. We don't always understand it, but it is always the best. So in 2 Kings 24 and 25, the last two chapters in the book of 2 Kings, because that ends the line of the kings of Israel. And we have, beginning in chapter 24, in his days, Nebuchadnezzar, that's Nebi 2, the one who was the great general, and who we read about in the book of Daniel, the guy who went out and ate grass for 7 years and who built the city, and is this not the city that I built, you know, the Hanging Babylon Gardens and all that stuff. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up. Now, this is right after his Carchemish victory in about 605 B.C. And so right after that, he came against Jerusalem and he conquered it. And Jehoiakim, who was just one guy we mentioned, became his vassal. Vassal means he's just kind of his appointed guy. He's supposed to be loyal to Babylon now, not to Israel. He's supposed to pay the tribute and so forth. For 3 years. Now we see Jehoiakim rebelling against Nebi, and the Lord sent against Nebuchadnezzar. This is against Israel. Isn't this amazing? But he sends against the raiding bands of the Chaldeans. Anytime you see Chaldeans, you can just use the term Babylonians in that date. A little later, Chaldeans comes to mean a little different thing. But in that time, it was a term used interchangeably with those from Babylon. And the Lord sent against some raiding bands of Chaldeans, bands from Syria, bands from Moab, bands from the people of Ammon. He sent them against Judah to destroy it. Why? According to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken by his servants the prophets. Surely at the commandment of the Lord, this came upon Judah to remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh. Now Manasseh was that son of Hezekiah who was born during Hezekiah's 15 years extension, probably about 12 years into that 15 year extension, I think. And he reigned for how long? Anybody know? 55 years. A wicked, wicked, wicked king. But the Lord left him there for 55 years. Now the guy did accept the Lord right at the end. He became a captive of Babylon and he turned to the Lord. But because of the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he had done, and also because of the innocent blood that he had shed. Now what do you think about the innocent blood the United States has shed? How about 70 million babies aborted? That's serious, isn't it? And that is there, and that's not going to go away. There will be the wrath of God poured out on that. Why else would he pour out his wrath on the same things being done in the time of the Bible? Innocent blood, that's typically having the little ones given over to Molech in the fire. They pass through the fire, and unwanted babies. And also, it was not just unwanted babies. Sometimes their firstborn, they would sacrifice to Molech for to give them good fortune, thinking that would help appease the gods and so forth. But according to the innocent blood that he had shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which the Lord would not pardon. Heavy duty. So when I see people who are called pro-choice, this is my body, I do with it what I wish, I just cringe, you know? I just cringe. But, you know, Father forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. They have no clue of what they're doing. But so much of the world right now is in protest, aren't they? Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles and so forth? Then Jehoiachin, his son, reigned in his place. So we have Kim and then Chin. And the king of Egypt did not come out of his land anymore, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the kings of Egypt from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. So what was happening during this time, you remember in Jeremiah's prophecy and Jeremiah's ministry in Jerusalem, he was saying, give up. Babylon is coming. Babylon is going to take this nation because of its wickedness. God is sending them to come. And if you don't give up, they'll destroy you. Well, what do? They throw him in the dungeon, right? They don't like those words. What do you mean? You're a traitor. You're saying we're going to fall. That's wrong. And all his prophets were saying we'll never fall and all that. Typical of what we have today. You know, we're strong and we're rich and all this, which is a joke, I guess. Anyway, then they said, we'll align ourselves with Egypt. Egypt will help us. So they're making alignment with a nation that in the history had been great, but Egypt is already toast now, or about to be final toasted by Babylon. So here they're aligning themselves not with the right party, right? They're going with the losers. They should have gone with the Lord. And, you know, Jeremiah was prophesying, don't go. What did he say? It's like a broken reed in your hand, right? That's what leaning on Egypt was like. Broken reed. So Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. Then he had a long reign, didn't he? His mother's name was Nehushta, daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. How would you like to have been the top appointed people working for Jehoiachin? You know, you wouldn't even get the good news out to your friends that you were in a high position until you were gone, right? I took office yesterday. Oh, this week I'm gone, you know, right? 3 months. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. And how do you do that much evil in 90 days? You've got to be wicked, don't you? At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city as his servants were besieging it. Then Jehoiachin, king of Judah, his mother, his servants, his princes, his officers, went out to the king of Babylon, and the king of Babylon, in the 8th year of his reign, took him prisoner. So that is the second deportation there. And he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king's house, and he cut in pieces all the articles of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, as the Lord had said. Also, he carried into captivity all Jerusalem, all the captains, all the mighty men of valor. Now, that first deportation, 605, was primarily just the noblemen. It was primarily just the kind of the cream of the crop in the nobility area. But it didn't include, you know, tradesmen and workers and industry leaders and all this. But now, it's the captains and all the mighty men of valor. That would be military as well. 10,000 captives, and that word 10,000 probably a round number. Obviously, of all the craftsmen and smiths. So now he's taking the knowledge, he's taking the skills that are there and taking them to Babylon and out of Israel. And he carried Jehoiachin captive to Babylon, the king's mother, the king's wives, his officers, and the mighty of the land. He carried into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon all the valiant men, 7,000, and craftsmen and smiths, 1,000, all who were strong and fit for war. These the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. Then the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, who also was called Zedekiah is really a better pronunciation, but anyway, Zedekiah, king in his place. He is 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He was the last guy. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. He also did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that Jehoiakim had done. So look at these wicked guys. Now, their father, Josiah, was a good king. He was one of the better kings of Israel, or of Judah. But the sons did not follow suit, did they? For because of the anger of the Lord, this happened in Jerusalem and Judah, that he finally cast them from his presence. Then Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Oh, thanks a lot. So now we have this guy Nebi coming in rage and just destroys it. So it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the 10th month, and the 10th day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and camped against it. They built a siege wall all around. So the city was besieged until the 11th year. So that was about 2 years of siege. By the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine became so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Then the city wall was broken through, and all the men of war fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden, even though the Chaldeans were still encamped all around the city. And the king went by way of the plain, but the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king, and they overtook him in the plains of Jericho. All his army was scattered from him. So they took the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and they pronounced judgment on him. Then they killed the sons, his sons, before his eyes, put out the eyes of Zedekiah, that's given to us in Jeremiah, bound him with bronze fetters, and took him to Babylon. In the 5th month, on the 7th day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebi, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. So he was the guy in charge to burn the temple and to destroy Jerusalem. He burned the house of the Lord, burned the temple, and the king's house, all the houses of Jerusalem, that is, all the houses of the great, he burned with fire. Now, if you go to Jerusalem today, there's different tours where you can see this layer of ash in there in the ruins. And very interesting, in those layers of ash, you find all these little gods. So they had, you know, a lot of little gods, all worshiping their little gods. It's sad. You can see it today. And all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls of Jerusalem all around. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive the rest of the people who remained in the city, and the defectors who had deserted to the king of Babylon with the rest of the multitude. But the captain of the guard left some of the poor of the land as vine dressers and farmers. The bronze pillars that were in the house of the Lord, and the carts and the bronze sea that were in the house, that's the labor, of course, that were in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans broke in pieces and carried their bronze to Babylon. They also took away the pots, the shovels, the trimmers, the spoons, and all the bronze utensils in which the princes or the priests ministered. The fire pans and the basins, the things of solid gold and solid silver, the captain and the guard took away. You know, it's very interesting. When Ezra comes back, after Cyrus gives the decree, and of course, you know, Cyrus was prophesied by Isaiah about 140, 150 years before he was born by name. And he was the king of the Persians that gave the command to go back to Jerusalem. And so then Ezra did, right? And we read that Ezra took back about 28 tons of gold and silver. About 25 tons of silver and about 3 tons of gold. That's a lot, isn't it? That's just what is coming back to Babylon. You know, not everything that was taken came back. And you know, if you want to talk about some logistics, that's something, isn't it? How would you get 28 tons on a bunch of camels and take them 400 or 500 miles, right? And you remember, Ezra was offered by the king protection, and early on he said, "Oh no, no, no! The Lord will protect us." But then, as they began their journey, I think they began to get really sober in a hurry, so they prayed and they fasted. And the Lord delivered them. They made that journey, and every item they had left with came to Jerusalem. Amazing protection, wasn't it? Because in those days, I mean, there were raiding bands, and here you have a long, not a convoy, I guess you have convoy, camel convoys, whatever you have with camels. Anyway, lots of camels, many camels, to get that much weight, and they would obviously be a very visible target, and they didn't have any weaponry against. They didn't have any protection, except they did have all the protection, right? Okay, the two pillars, one the sea, the carts which Solomon had made for the house of the Lord, the bronze of all these articles was beyond measure. Verse 17, the height of one pillar was 18 cubits, and the capital on it was of bronze. The height of the capital was 3 cubits, the network, pomegranates all around the capital were of bronze. The second pillar was the same with the network. And the captain of the guard took Sariah, the chief priest, Zephaniah, the second priest, and the 3 doorkeepers. He also took out of the city an officer who had charge of the men of war, 5 men of the king's close associates who were found in the city, the chief recruiting officer, and so forth. So Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, took these and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah. Then the king of Babylon struck them and put them to death at Riblah in the land of Hamath. Thus Judah was carried away captive from its own land. There's some more there about the guy who was made the governor of Judah, and then Jehoiachin over in Babylon was released from prison. Now, it's also, I'm not going to read it because it's fairly redundant. In 2 Chronicles 36, we have the Chronicles account of the same thing. You might want to read that if you're interested. But turn to Jeremiah. We have a lot in Jeremiah about this same thing. And as I mentioned, Jeremiah now is in where?
Babylon.
No.
Oh, he's in Jerusalem.
He's in Jerusalem. And so he's prophesying in Jerusalem at the same time Ezekiel is prophesying in Babylon, right? And here is what Jeremiah is saying to the people in Jerusalem at this time. In Jeremiah 37, verse 1, we read the following. Jeremiah 37, 1. Now King Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, reigned instead of Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim. We also had, remember, calling him Jehoiachin, he's also called Kaniah, and the son of Jehoiakim, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, made king of the land of Judah, but neither he nor his servants nor the people of the land gave heed to the words of the Lord, which he spoke by the prophet Jeremiah. And Zedekiah the king sent Jehukal, the son of Shelemiah, and Zephaniah, the son of Maaseiah, the priest, to the prophet Jeremiah, saying, pray now to the Lord our God for us. Now Jeremiah was coming and going among the people, for they had not yet put him in prison. And Pharaoh's army came up from Egypt, and when the Chaldeans who were besieging Jerusalem heard news of them, they departed from Jerusalem. So this now gives Jerusalem some hope that Israel can still rely on Egypt. And so these guys keep going back to, they want to align themselves with Egypt instead of turning to the Lord. And so he goes on and tells them more about these things. And then in the latter part of chapter 37, he's imprisoned. And in 38, he gets thrown in the dungeon. And then they had this, there's some thought about, well, maybe we shouldn't just kill him. So who's the king? In verse 5, Zedekiah. Zedekiah. This was a guy named Mathaniah whose name was also changed or called Zedekiah, the last king. Zedekiah said, look, he's in your hands. So he didn't do anything to keep him from going into the dungeon. So they put him into the dungeon of Malchiah, the king's son, which was in the court of the prison. And they let Jeremiah down with ropes. And in the dungeon there was no water but mire, mud. And he sank in the mire. Now Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, one of the eunuchs who was in the king's house, heard that they'd put Jeremiah in the dungeon. And so he gets a bunch of guys, 30 men, and they go down, let down ropes, and they pull him back out of there. And so Zedekiah sent and had Jeremiah the prophet brought to him in verse 14 at the third entrance of the house of the Lord. And the king said to Jeremiah, I will ask you something, hide me nothing. Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, if I declare it to you, will you not surely put me to death? And if I give you advice, you will not listen to me. So Zedekiah the king swore secretly to Jeremiah, saying, as the Lord lives, who made our very souls, I will not put you to death, nor will I give you into the hand of those who seek your life. And Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, thus says the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, if you surely surrender to the king of Babylon's princes, then your soul shall live. this city shall not be burned with fire, and you and your house shall live. But if you do not surrender to the king of Babylon's princes, then this city shall be given into the hands of the Chaldeans. They shall burn it with fire, and you shall not escape from your hand. And Zedekiah the king said to Jeremiah, I am afraid of the Jews who have defected to the Chaldeans, lest they deliver me into their hand and they abuse me, and so forth. So then we see in verse 39 the fall of Jerusalem in the ninth year of Zedekiah. Now Zedekiah came to reign in about 597. So the ninth year would have been what, 588? This is 2 years before the fall. In the tenth month, as Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem, besieged it. In the 11th year, that's 586, in the fourth month of the ninth day, and it really has it down to the day, doesn't it? The city was penetrated, then all the princes of the king of Babylon came in, and so forth, and that's when they burned everything and took everybody out of there. So we see here that this is told to us over and over again in a way, isn't it? Isn't the Bible great? We got it in Chronicles, we got it in Kings, we got it in Jeremiah, we got part of it in Ezekiel. We got a little of it in Daniel, and I mean the part about Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar writes one whole chapter in the book of Daniel, right? It's the one chapter that's not written in Hebrew. It was written in his language. Interesting, isn't it? Okay, so when did it happen? We've already talked about that. Nineveh, great city, fell to the Babylonians in 612, and Nabopolassar, not only led the armies in 612, but also with the help of the Medes, he drove out the forces of Assyria and Egypt once for all in 610. And his son, Nebuchadnezzar, then had that great victory in 605 at Carchemish. And if you look on the map, Carchemish is a little bit north of today's Syria, still a city. And that victory is recorded in Jeremiah 26. And then we had the second son, Jehoiakim. He had at least four. We know the names of four. We don't know how many more he had. But he had at least four, called Eliakim, who was made a vassal, and so forth. And then he rebelled, and then Jehoiakim was in for a whopping 3 months, and then he did evil. And we have here, this word came to him by the river, which is actually a canal. This is really the Kabar Canal. You can see it on a map today. They think they know where it is. It kind of ran parallel to the river Euphrates. It would leave up there, and then they had a couple of branches that went off to tie into the Tigris. So that's this area. It's thought to be anywhere from 30 to 80 miles from the city of Babylon itself, where this city Tel Aviv was. They don't really know for sure, but it was along this canal, we're told that. And so then in 597, we have the fourth son, Zedekiah, or Mattaniah, put in, and he was in for 11 years. And then it says, like 8 years later, he joined with Tyre, Ammon, and Edom in a revolt against Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar responds in rage. And finally, the city of Jerusalem was destroyed along with the temple. So going on down, Jeremiah had been preaching in Jerusalem about 4 years when Ezekiel was born. We know Jeremiah was a youth because in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 6, Jeremiah is resisting the call into the ministry, saying, who would listen to a youth? And that word in the Hebrew typically would apply to anything from a child to an adult, probably a teenager. If Jeremiah indeed was a teenager when he started his ministry and he had ministered 4 years when Ezekiel was born, he would have been about 20 years plus or minus older than Ezekiel. Ezekiel and Daniel were about the same age, we think. You know, Daniel got taken in the first deportation, but we thought he was a teenager. And Ezekiel in the second deportation was 25, so at the time of Daniel was taken, he would have been a teenager too. And so they probably knew each other. They probably knew each other. Maybe, I don't know how well, but they probably did. And we see these three guys then prophesying at the same time. Where was Ezekiel at this time? Well, it says he was among the captives. And the term in there, in Ezekiel 3:14, 22, 8:1, Ezekiel down at the bottom there, it says, no, that's the hand of the Lord, I'm sorry. Being one of the captives, it's shown in the Bible several times too. So he was a captive by the river Kabar. And what was the prophecy? Well, God was really revealing himself. The heavens were open and I saw the visions of God. And so he's giving Ezekiel these visions. Now, as we go on through this book, you will see the people aren't listening, and so God resorts to some interesting pantomimes, if you will, For example, one of the ones he's told to go into his house, dig a tunnel, and come out in the middle of the street. Now, you and I don't think too much of that, I guess, because we all have manhole covers, and what's the big deal? But in those days, they didn't have that. And for somebody to come up out of the middle of the street, that would get your attention, wouldn't it? I guess it was maybe the main street. I don't know. But he does different things, you know. He lays on one side for a while, and then on the other side, and all to get their attention. All to get their attention, to listen to the Lord. And so it was a response directed specifically to Ezekiel. Over 50 times in the book, he says, the word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel. Wow. Isn't that great? How would you like to have your name in history like that? Maybe just once, let alone 50 times, right? Anyway, 50 times. A realization of God's presence, the hand of the Lord was there upon him, and that term, the hand of the Lord upon him, is given to us in several places in Ezekiel. So we see this great prophecy. Now, as we go back to page 1 again, in closing, just looking at the outline here, this happens to be Warren Wiersbe's outline. Every commentator has their own, but they're all about the same. And I just picked this one because I kind of could understand it pretty well. But we see, as we already mentioned, the theme is the glory of God. Some say it's restoring the spiritual heart of the nation. The key verse we've already mentioned, you shall know that I am the Lord. And then the first three verses here, I'm sorry, the first three chapters here, we have Ezekiel's call. We have Ezekiel's call. And the first one is seeing God's glory, is how Wiersbe describes it. So as you read chapter 1 and read it for next time, be thinking about seeing God's glory and seeing see if you can get anything out of it. I mean, it's kind of weird. You got this chariot. It's empty. It's God, but its chariot is empty. Got wheels very high, surrounded with eyes. And it goes either direction, goes forward, backward, up or down, as the Spirit leads it. Interesting. And, you know, these visions are not, I mean, we look at Revelation, that's a book with visions, you know, and so John there is describing through the Spirit things that are going to happen thousands of years from now. And so how can you describe war machines that you've never seen? And this is maybe somewhat similar, but there is something there for us. It's in the Bible. Ezekiel chapter 2 is about hearing the word of the God, hearing God's word. And then chapter 3, we get into being God's watchman. And all of those would be appropriate to you and I. We want to see God's glory, don't we? We want to hear his word, don't we? We want to become his watchman, don't we? Then in the next 21 chapters, chapter 4 through 24, we have the fall of Jerusalem. So this is pretty much gloom and doom stuff in here. For the most part, judgment predicted. The God's glory departs. Godless leaders exposed. God's justice defended. The end of the city in Ezekiel 22:24. Then we have the nations judged. And you'll notice all those nations are basically adjacent to Israel. Ammon, Moab, Edom, Philistia, Tyre, Sidon, Egypt. Now, you'll notice there in Tyre, Ezekiel 26-28, that's where that great statement about Satan is in, right? We have in Isaiah 14 and in Ezekiel 28 the description of Satan. They're talking about the king of Tyre, but then they switch to Satan in there. So that's an interesting one. Then we have Sidon, we have Egypt. And then the last 33-48, that's 16 chapters, we have the good news. The glorious future of Israel. We have the city of Jerusalem being restored, Ezekiel 33, dry bones, Ezekiel 34. Then we have the land renewed, Ezekiel 35-36. And then we have the nation of Israel resurrected and reunited, 37-39. And most of us think we're in Ezekiel 38 right now. If you look at the restoration of Israel, if you go over there today, you'll see some remarkable things have happened. They planted over, 2 million trees. I don't know how many trees they planted, but they've been in this reforestation program. Because during the Israel was basically abandoned for years. And the Ottomans at one point, I think it was the Ottoman Empire, they levied a tax against trees, so you had to pay tax for every tree you had, so people cut all the trees down. Now, many of the trees were cut by the Babylonians and then by the Romans to make siege walls, right? So at the time of the Roman siege, it was told that there was not a tree within 12 miles of the city. They'd cut down every tree that they could find to make logs to build siege walls. And so since Israel is right here between, you know, in this period of time, a little bit earlier than this period of time, well, and then later, after the Greeks, you know, Alexander, you know, turned, when he died, he didn't pick a successor. He just gave it to his four generals. And the Seleucids were on one side, the Ptolemaics on the other side. And they were the two strongest ones. And they would go back and forth, trampling Israel every time they went back and forth. So Israel was just trodden underfoot all this time, you know. And so the trees had a tough time, you know. But we see the trees being replanted. We see now Israel is one of the leading fresh fruit exporters in the world. And here's this tiny little country, not even any bigger than New Jersey. I mean, it is tiny. You go to Israel, I mean, you go up in the Golan, you can look down and it's like looking, I mean, it's like being at Twin Peaks and looking out and seeing the Pacific Ocean. I mean, it's about that far and you're looking across the whole northern part of Israel. It's about 20 miles from the Golan to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, the country widens a little bit as you go on down, but nevertheless, it's still a very small country. They also are huge in fresh flowers, big exporters of fresh flowers. The Sharon Plains, which is near Caesarea, that would be north of Tel Aviv, north of Joppa, by about 30 miles, that was all swampland. Because what had happened during the desolation period there, when nobody was in Israel, the sand came out of the Nile and washed up against the shore on the east side of the Mediterranean and plugged up all of the natural drainage exits of that area. And so they got stopped up, so the water just is all swamps. Malaria, terrible. And the Arabs ended up with the land. So when the Jews started to come back into the land, they were selling them this land, worthless swamp land, they said, and these idiot Jews were buying it from them. But it's God's plan, right? And then they brought in a lot of eucalyptus trees, and they opened up the drainage areas and all, and that is fabulous land now. I mean, it's a Sharon Plain. The Sharon Plain is great, really very, very productive plain. So we see a lot of these prophecies of Ezekiel have already happened and are happening right before our eyes. And so as we get into those, we will see that more clearly, I believe. Nation of Israel resurrected and reunited in the three chapters of 37, 38, 39. And then it switches, and in the last nine chapters, 40 to 48, we have the temple and the priesthood reestablished. So what in the world do you need the temple and the priesthood reestablished for in the millennial reign? Are we looking forward to the Messiah? He's already come. I think we'll be looking back to the Messiah. But we'll be offering sacrifices not for atonement of sin. That's already been paid for, right? Then Jesus paid on the cross, so we won't be going to sacrifices for the covering of sin. But I think there'll be sacrifices of praise and sacrifices of offering. And we hope to learn more. I hope to learn more as we go through that about the millennial reign. I've never really understood much about those last chapters. I've been through it twice with Pastor Chuck, and both times kind of skipped through it a little bit here and a little bit there. And maybe there's not all that much. There's a lot of dimensions and all that thing, and I recognize that probably isn't the most interesting thing in the world. But we'll take enough of time to get through it anyway. You know, we went through Leviticus word by word, verse by verse, and I thought it was such a blessing. And you look at commentators, they'll cover four or five or six verses with one statement kind of a thing, and we'll probably make a few more statements out of it. So read ahead in chapter 1, if you will, and then you can really help in the next session by taking over and teaching it, maybe. Maybe that would work, right? Because I probably won't know what it's all about. But I'll be praying about it. Pray for me. I leave tomorrow for Brazil for 2 weeks, and also for my visa that it gets here today or tomorrow. It did leave Washington last night. I got a tracking number on FedEx, so it's not like I'm totally in the dark. And and there was bad weather in Memphis, but I got the word. It's really neat now. You can go on the internet and track these things and see every time the plane takes off and all that kind of stuff. And it got to Memphis all right, so that's good news. I didn't get word that it left Memphis yet, but it's supposed to be here at this point. Anyway, if the Lord wants me to go, I'll go. If he doesn't want me to go, then I don't have a visa. I'll stay here. I'll see you next week. or leave later, one of the two. But I'm hoping to meet with some Baptist pastors Thursday night. They want to learn about grace. Isn't that great?
Oh, yeah.
We were able to publish Grace Changes Everything and Living Water and a couple of other books in Portuguese, and these are being sold through some bookstores there, and the Grace Changes Everything has been fabulously well received, and so they wanted to know, they heard I was coming through, would I come to a grand opening of one of their stores as representative of Calvary Chapel, representative Pastor Chuck, really, and I said, sure, you know. And then they called back and said, well, since you're coming, these pastors want to know if you would teach an evening on grace. So isn't that something? I mean, just go through for one night and, you know. So I think the Lord will have my visa here if he wants me down there with these guys. And so keep that in prayer, too. But can you think of anything more exciting than telling people about the grace of God? I mean, oh, it's so awesome, right? His love, so much. And so much of the, you know, church is wrapped up in legalism and all that and not really... still with a tinge of works in it, you know. And by grace you are saved through faith, right? I got a copy in Portuguese, which can't read, but I got a copy in English, which can read. Now, a few years ago, I went to Cuba. I gave a message on grace quite a number of times because we went from place to place and we had gotten the book translated into Spanish and we were introducing it to the Spanish pastors there. So we were teaching on grace there as well. So anyway, let's close in prayer. If you have some questions, we'll try to take them. Father, just thank you for my precious brothers and sisters and their attentiveness. And as we look forward to this book, Lord, just help us to open our hearts and minds to what you have for us. May your will be done. May your kingdom come in our hearts here on earth as it already has. But may we understand that it is. And may we be vessels of light and vessels of salt in this dark and dying world, creating a thirst for you. So bless each one here. Use them today. May we tell somebody today about your great love for them. And may someone through our lives come to know you today or someone's. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.